Thank you, and good morning, afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to the March meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. We will be doing a combined work session and business session today, so we do have a long agenda, which means we need to get started right away. We'll take a very brief break after item 6 on the work session agenda, and if things go wrong, we may take a break after number 4 or 5. Depending upon how things go. So all that's to say is brevity will be rewarded, and we have a fairly short agenda. We will, for members of the public here, we will be taking public comment at the start of the business session, which will be after the work session, and the bulk of the time will be spent today on the work session. So are there any folks here who intend to comment under public comment time? Okay, and that'll probably be a couple hours after we get through the work session items. With that, I'd like to call up the work session agenda and a very important item. Commissioner Eckern here is to report on VDOT's focus on emergency response as well as some precipitating events. That's not a bad metaphor. No one even noticed. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And members, good afternoon. The team of brevity is rewarded. Are there any questions? No, we won't go there. At your places, you'll find two reports that are being posted on our website at 1 o'clock that are the after-action reports from the events of February 12th in Northern Virginia and the Springfield Interchange. These slides work through those two reports that you've got. The first report is my report. It's authored by me in cooperation with the Research Council and with assistance from the Office of Commonwealth Preparedness and the Virginia State Police. I took that on as a personal task to review the events of February 12th. The second report that you have, which is co-signed by Mordezai Salahi and Connie Sorrell, is their response to the action items that were identified in the first report, so that you've got those in context as you work through those. What I want to talk about then is something that, when you look at statistics every winter in the Commonwealth, I want to give you a little context. You can form some opinions about our business activities. And, you know, we tend to use these terms, business activities, and think about ourselves as a business. And sometimes in that process, you lose sight of some of the important things that we do in those business activities. And so I can paint you a picture on a statewide basis that every winter, we'll have 12 to 15 snow and ice events that are spread beyond a local area, cross district boundaries, result in quite a bit of coordination between the Operations Emergency Center here and our local TMCs and districts and all the personnel that are working. 12 to 15 of those on average every year. When you run the numbers on them, any one of those events will range in cost from $2.5 to $7.5 million as a result of all the activity, the materials we use, the time, the labor, and all those kinds of things. But you know, on February 12th, an event that would have otherwise appeared just in one of those 12 to 15 really brought home how important a business activity that we talk about called operations and emergency response really is to the economy, the quality of life, and the safety of the people who use our system every day. And that's really why I wanted to spend this time and report to the board what it is that occurred on February 12th. And that report looks like this. It was the perfect convergence of events. It was coming together of freezing rain and a marginal temperature range, 28 to 34 degrees. It hit at a very critical period of the day, about 3 p.m., and it turned on us in about 45 minutes. And that caused the next series of events that went on for about 12 hours in Northern Virginia. This map, as you see it in the overhead, shows you that, you know, on a precipitation basis, it was very little water. It was about 1/18, 2/10 of an inch, but it froze. And it froze in critical locations. And it froze across Northern Virginia, into D.C., and into Maryland. So it was a widespread regional event. I've chosen to focus at the Springfield Interchange because it was highly visible. We had these same effects throughout Northern Virginia during that 12-hour period. But at the Springfield Interchange, that 45 minutes, resulted in the closure of all the major ramps intersecting 495, 95, and 395. And it took us anywhere from 2.5 to 8 hours to get those ramps reopened. That's how impactful the weather can be. The congestion, in terms of statistics, if you look at it, BSP that night reported a total in Northern Virginia of about 331 crashes. About 108 of those were at the Springfield Interchange location. In your report, you'll find a detailed table by hour of how that crash sequence occurred. And it highlights that critical period right around 3 to 4 o'clock. This, and it's a little hard to read on the screen, I apologize for that, is now as you reconstruct what led up to that critical 45 minutes, you plot what we rely on very heavily in the winter season, which is weather forecasting supplemented by a service that we have for the department provided through VISLA, which supplements National Weather Service information, plotted against what we had done in preparation, mobilization, and then deployment. In fact, in the report, it traces back into February 11th, because we'll be looking 24 to 36 hours in advance. And you can see the forecasts as we saw them reported at 4:14 in the morning, 4:22, what kind of advisories we were getting, and for what areas of Northern Virginia. And along the right-hand column, what you see then is how the district responds to that. In the course of doing their normal jobs, the way they do their mobilization, they look at those reports, and at about 7:23, our leadership in Northern Virginia issued a request to their superintendents to give them mobilization plans based on a pre-established set of protocols with this weather forecast. That activity takes till about 9:47 in the morning when those plans are redistributed to the superintendents and resulted in putting on the street and being ready with about 278 trucks in preparation. That's mobilization. That's out of a fleet of about 1,300 that Northern Virginia can field in an all-out snowstorm. So that tells you that at the level of event that they were anticipating, they felt that 278 vehicles or pieces of equipment would be enough to deal with that. In after action, as we looked at that, we discovered and found that only 6 of those vehicles were deployed and focused at the Springfield interchange. Because of the way they anticipated the weather pattern to go north, as opposed to that rapid shift that occurred that blew through the interchange. You can see on the timeline in response as the weather predictions change. For instance, at 117, we're starting to get freezing pavement temperatures, or pavement temperatures, but a forecast of not freezing. But at 316, right in that 1 to 2 hour period, it changed. The forecast changed. And the response that was going on as the district realized what was happening, revisited with their superintendents and increased the number of vehicles that they would need to 295 to respond to what they felt was going to be the event that they dealt with. Then you see the events as they rapidly occur between 4:30, and then the after action, the after event, opening ramps, and you see the final around midnight, the last ramps were reopened at the Springfield interchange, and traffic was reported as being at normal production. I sat down with the staff immediately, or within 7 days of the event. We pulled together key people that were involved in the event, Virginia State Police troopers and leadership that was involved in the event, and the Office of Commonwealth Preparedness, along with my staff, both here and in Northern Virginia, to debrief what we learned or what we saw, what happened. We did a lot of interviews. And then out of that, I produced findings, that at least that I saw, that came out of about six areas that were the result of this event. First, when you looked at the weather forecasts, we had advanced knowledge. We had advanced knowledge. Geographic spread was not perfect. Our RWIS equipment was not as fully deployed as it should be or could be. And so consequently, we had gaps in our information. And we had marginal temperatures that we were looking at, 28 to 34 degrees, air temperature versus pavement temperature. Pavements will generally be warmer than air temperature, but bridges will more than likely reflect the air temperature because they're steel, and they're unsupported, and they don't have reflective heat coming from ground level. So consequently, we missed that, because we missed it with a data gap. Second, we looked at our mobilization, and you'll see there are a series of findings around how does mobilization work. The district, to its credit, has one of the most unique pre-mobilization plans that has been established throughout the Commonwealth. They have determined, based on weather conditions and anticipated forecasts, levels of response so that it simplifies and quickly mobilizes or could mobilize forces based on a seven-level architecture. And we've included that as an appendix in the report so you can see it. To my knowledge, that's not being done elsewhere around the Commonwealth at this point. But what did we also find? We also found that if you have good advanced knowledge, you can mobilize and be ready. But in the flow of the event, if you need to mobilize additional equipment, you will experience a time lag of anywhere from an hour and a half to 3 hours to get equipment on site, to get that equipment set up, and get it back out on the road. That's because we use a mix of private sector as well as public, as well as our own owned vehicles. So that was a key finding for me. Then we also, obviously, you learn real quick, key finding. Once you've lost it, recovery is much harder. It's much harder because people are stuck on ramps. Now you're trying to move equipment into the area to get it de-iced so it can get open. And that just exacerbates the problem. Communications was a third area that We had multiple issues that we discovered in our findings. One, our staff at the TMC was overwhelmed with calls. So they focused on answering a certain segment of the calls. We did not have our public affairs people there where they should have been to be able to respond to media calls. And so our staff was focused more at responding to customer and media calls than they were at helping deploy equipment and get people moved where they needed to be. The communications lapsed between our TMC and our central office, EEOC, so that we could get messages flooded across the system where they needed to be. Traveler information is the second piece of that communications pipeline in which we did not get the messages onto the 511 system in as quickly as we could have. We did not get the message boards used that could have been used to get messages across further south and further north of the metropolitan area so that the drivers would have had an opportunity to pull off or go somewhere else on their trips home. So that's a key learning area that we found. And we found that our variable message signs, the signs that we have deployed throughout the system in Northern Virginia, those are the ones that are on trailers, needed to be repositioned. And so that might have helped get customers off the system. We also looked at and had key findings around the chain of command that needs to go on in emergency response. We subscribe to, as does the Commonwealth, the National Incident Management System, NIMS. We use it predominantly for truck crashes, for truck rollovers, for incidents. We have not fully implemented it in winter snow and ice control. But it is that discipline that establishes a clear chain of command, a communication pipeline, and all the discipline that we feel we need in emergency response. Keep finding. Under the snow and ice removal techniques, and I could never find the right title to capture this category, but the intent of that is to look at our practices in preparation. We have, and across the country, been experimenting with anti-icing principles versus de-icing principles. Now, inside the profession, that's a unique distinction. Anti-icing says you can treat a pavement in advance of an event, several days in advance of an event, and prevent the bond that will occur between ice and pavement, if you do it right. Versus de-icing, which means you're reactive, and exactly what you saw going on, you put sand and salt on it or you put chemical on it after the event to get it to melt away. That's a changing trend. And while we had limited pieces of equipment that could have done anti-icing, they were not deployed for this event. That's my quick review of the key findings. What have we done in follow-up as a result of the event? February 13th, I'm told that this is one of the few times in the history of VDOT that this has ever occurred. When we realized what had occurred, I issued a news release immediately following the event, letting people know that this is unacceptable to us as a department and us as professionals who work in this business. And in effect, tried to get the message as clearly as I could that we were apologizing to the community for what had occurred on the 12th. We implemented the action steps that I outlined in terms of pulling people together to find out what happened. And on the 14th of February, I appeared before the Senate Transportation Committee to give them as much information as I knew at the time in debriefing from the event that had occurred. The February 20th is when I called people together. On the 28th of this month is when February is when I produced the report that I provided to the secretary, which was the 19-item action plan that you see before you in that report. And on March 7th, I got, or 10th, I think I got the second report from Mordezai, which said 16 of the 19 action items have now been implemented and in place. But more importantly, following forward from that, and I'll talk about that in a minute, is the longer range plan over the next 18 months. Summary of the action steps that you see in the report very quickly are, first, we changed chain of command and the way we're doing business. Key staff, both from the Virginia State Police and my staff, for any event, now congregate at the command post, the TMC. That's to ensure that decision-making does not have to go through two chains or three chains in order to get a decision made when it needs to mobilize additional equipment or we need to redeploy equipment from one location to another. We have also made sure that there are public affairs people to supplement the TMC staff to deal with media inquiries and ensure that we're getting messages out into the public as quickly as possible. We have changed our operations. For the Springfield interchange through the remainder of the winter, the district upstaffed and fully mobilized for any event. That means instead of 6 pieces of equipment, there were 15 pieces of equipment that were ready and mobilized for any event going on at the Springfield interchange. And that has been very clear. They also improved their protocols in terms of reviewing and mobilizing appropriate levels of equipment more quickly. In the 2 events that have occurred since the 12th, I think people have seen the effects of that mobilization. Pre-positioned trucks, fully staffed, and ready to be where they need to be if the event mobilized or developed the way we anticipated it. We have issued directives within the department to improve communications protocols between our regional TMCs and our central emergency operations center. That took the form of 2 directives. We also deployed additional technology. Admittedly, it was fast reaction, but we gave each of our safety service patrollers and supervisors about 100 thermal temperature measuring devices to fill the gaps where ARWIS is not at within the system. So that means that people can be much more responsive and get us information more quickly. All those things, I think, are having an impact. The last 2 action items are the long-term action items that I have taken on personally as an initiative within the department over the next 6 to 18 months. Around the 15th of April, I will prepare and distribute a long-term forward plan to address the agency's emergency response mission. I've already started a series of meetings. I've met with our maintenance engineers and operations directors from across the Commonwealth last week. This next week, I'll be meeting with all of the districts in order to gather input in the development of that plan. We will then launch a program that will respond to those improvement areas that we see as critical and implementable over the next 18 months. Key to that will be a focus around emergency response, preparedness, and training. We have several institutes today where we focus at good construction inspection techniques and good project management techniques. This will add the third leg to the stool. How do you prepare and rehearse and get ready for emergency response? Lastly, we will ensure that within this long-range plan that we have consistent protocols and chains of command within the organization, that we have fully implemented the NIMS principles for all emergencies, including snow and ice control, that we are in fact, balancing our contract resources between VDOT and contract resources that are available to us. There is no doubt in this Commonwealth that the private sector and the public sector are in a unique partnership when it comes to dealing with emergency response. That partnership is critical and needs to be managed as that kind of a partnership. That means a lot within the organization when you talk about how do you do that. We will probably be looking at equipment and the types of equipment our people have if we're to fully implement the anti-icing program throughout the Commonwealth, which I think will pay tremendous benefits. And we will ensure that we have clear, focused accountability in any emergency that we deal with. This event, at the end of the day, does make crystal clear kind of the importance of emergency response as we've come to know it and come to understand it. And I want to end with what I started with the Senate Transportation Committee. We clearly understand and don't think a 9-hour closure of a major transportation facility anywhere in the Commonwealth is acceptable. Whether it's in Northern Virginia, whether it's in Bristol, whether it's in Roanoke. My staff, myself, and the employees of this department are committed to the best possible service that we can give the taxpayer. And we take these kinds of events very, very seriously. I see this not as a negative, but as a wake-up call and an opportunity to really bring us to the agency that you expect us to be. With that, I'll open to questions, Mr. Secretary.
Questions, comments? Ms. Conley.
Thank you very much. You gave a very sober but a very, I think, wise appraisal. It was a kind of shocking event in Northern Virginia, but it was, I think, to everybody's credit, a very unusual set of circumstances, but I'm just so glad you're taking this as seriously as it is, because it will, I think, move us to a better place. And this whole idea of the anti-icing, I'm very intrigued with, and think that, you know, prevention is a very wise approach. But I'd like to know, what is the distinction, because I am from Northern Virginia, and congestion is caused by one person running out of gas. What is the distinction between emergency management and incident management? Because in our area, an incident is also a very serious thing. Or what, in your mind, where does one start and the other end?
I appreciate the question. That's an absolutely excellent question. I predict that by the end of this year, you will see no distinction. Each incident is an emergency. We will treat it that way.
A perfect answer.
Ms. Coulomb?
Thank you. I appreciate the thoroughness of your assessment. I think that was necessary. It was not simply inconvenience. It was actually major safety and health problems that were going on, people who were trapped there. One woman just said you couldn't even step out of your car without falling on your keister. So they couldn't even walk off a ramp or take kids to use the bathroom or, you know, all these things that we don't think about that are related to the inability to move. I was also encouraged by your emphasis on operations, period. And I think probably we need, as a board, to understand our need to continue to commit increasing amounts of resources to operations per se. Not only is it a good use of our money to get the most out of the capacity that we have, even as we add to the capacity, but in the end, incidents are emergencies, or they can turn into them. Now, having said that, I will tell you this, and as I did before the meeting, no weather event is more insidious than freezing rain. I mean, it poses a special set of challenges, and I think drivers know that as well as you know that now. It's something that we need to be much more aware of in the future. Finally, I would ask you this. This event isn't on the magnitude of Hurricane Katrina, but Congressman Tom Davis's Government Operations Committee, as he looked into what happened at Katrina, he warned about something that I think is very important, and that in this case, FEMA, he said, was looking for an event that fit its pre-existing abilities to respond, as opposed to looking at the event's unique character and then being truly responsive. The military, police forces, other organizations have had to learn to decentralize their operations so that they get more data points, they get more initiative, they get more entrepreneurial response to what's actually in front of people on the ground. And I'd like to just ask you about that. If you consider that a framework for thinking about that, is do what you've already thought about kind of reflect your thinking in that same direction?
Another good point, and very frankly, you're right on target. Within the department, as I talk about the future of VDI, I've tried to talk about the four business lines, one of which is operations and maintenance. Within the operations and maintenance business line that we will have, the theme will be we will be more like the 82nd Airborne than we will a routine maintenance operation. And my purpose in saying that is our focus will be on systems, not areas, and no boundaries. And my expectation is that at the end of the day, those people charged with maintenance and operations responsibility will think about system and system continuity, not their little, not the geographic area, I shouldn't say little, geographic area that they serve, which has been our model for the last 80 years. That is significant in its cultural change that will be required of the staff that I have. Luckily, we have an extremely experienced staff, and I think they are up to that challenge to say, we can do this a different way.
One additional comment, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Commissioner. You wouldn't necessarily know this, but this problem with interoperability or incompatibility of the communication system is something that was identified in the Commonwealth 15 years ago and simply hasn't ever been addressed in a comprehensive way. So I hope, if we can, we'll let you use this incident as yet another example of why those plans need to be speeded up and we need to get to that better result sooner.
Yeah, there's some telling stories inside that report that talk about how people had to go about communicating with one another. It's fascinating.
Thank you.
Ms. Durham.
I happen to be one of those people sitting on the interstate waiting to go south, so I've got a sort of a personal stake in it. But one of the things, whenever you're dealing with any incident of this nature or any potential incident, you've got a certain degree of risk analysis. Something may happen. How much are you going to pay, or how prepared are you going to be for that? In this particular case, it wasn't completely predictable. We had a certain degree of, we'll spend some money to be prepared for a much smaller scale incident. It turned out to be larger. Next two events, as you noted, I saw on the news, hey, we may have something, and I saw the VDOT trucks parked there, loaded with the chemicals, ready to go should anything happen. Turned out I don't think we needed them as much. They did deploy some of those chemicals, but there's obviously a cost involved with that. What is our new sort of standard of risk that we're going to accept? I mean, this is a higher degree of preparation. That's a higher degree of cost. So what is our new risk that we find acceptable? What is the cost that we're going to now incur on an annual basis? And what was the cost associated for preparation of this? I mean, I say this because we're in a limited budget environment. So that obviously, I assume, is in the mix.
My rough estimates right now are in two answers to that question. Today, on an annualized basis, if you look at the way we track snow and ice, that's about $80 million annually. It's been up as high as $115 million. But on average, we allocate about $80 million annually for snow and ice. My prediction is that because the safety net may be an edge low. And if you look at the 7-level chart, I might look at that today and say that should only be 5 levels. 1 and 2 should be combined. That will cause perhaps as much as a 25% increase. So you can see us going up to somewhere around $100 million. And whether that comes from redistribution of current resources, it is a fixed dollar. and it will make differences in pavement condition or bridge condition or some other aspect of our business, because it has to come from somewhere. So the hard answer to that question is, yes, we need to up on an event level basis statewide. We know it's about $7.5 million per event. I think you've mentioned to me before, that sounds like a couple of important road projects on the secondary system. So every one of those events will cost us that kind of money.
And when you testified before the Senate, did they offer you the additional money?
Not the
rhetorical question.
Not the first time.
You meant it well.
Mr. Commissioner, excellent report. Applaud what you're doing, but like Mr. Sterling, I'll offer a word of caution. I think it's easy for us to take an event like this, go through a study, and in the process of raising the bar and trying to make sure it doesn't happen again, we can go overboard to a level of performance that, one, we can't afford, and two, it's trying to have a system in place for the unlikely event. You made the statement saying that it's unacceptable for a major artery to be closed for 9 hours. I predict if a Category 4 hurricane comes through Hampton Roads, we will have those tunnels closed for 9 hours, and I doubt there's anything you can do to prevent that from happening or to even want to open that road earlier than 9 hours. So you have to be careful where you set the bar and what we do and what we accept as the standard of performance.
Absolutely excellent point. I can't endorse it more emphatically than to say, as we move forward, that is why I am gathering the district maintenance engineers together with the operations and the district administrators to ensure that we set the first bar correctly. The second piece of this, and it's Member Connolly's comment earlier, it's not just about snow and ice. It is about closing 95, 81, 64 for 19 hours because of a tanker rollover and an inability to get the right kind of equipment there. That will cause policy change. It may in fact cause the need to change some code within the Commonwealth to put those arteries back into service. Not a cost associated with it, but a change in responsibilities. That's a hard set of questions that are going to come up over the next 18 months, very frankly. And I have to raise that. I don't have a choice.
Ms. Coleman.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. That was an interesting point you just raised. Clearly, neither the geography of a broad area like Northern Virginia nor the complexity of the systems, if we think of 95 as a system, very different than 66 as a system. And yet, we are organized by districts. We do have district administrators in charge of operations and maintenance, and our response mechanisms are kind of determined by political boundaries as opposed to the realities. Is that the kind of breaking down some of those things that you talked about in the systems?
Yes, I need district administrators to represent me in the field. But the challenge for every DOT, including this one, is while he has a geographic responsibility for some purposes, he has a system responsibility for others. And that means you have to start to think seamlessly about how you coordinate and communicate with other elements around you. We've made some strides in that direction when we looked at the operations piece and we set up the 5 regional communication centers. Those were a signal, and the boundaries were purposely set to not match district boundaries. There's some pluses and there's some minuses to that. We're going to adjust a part of that as a part of this discussion. But I predict that those TMCs will take on a role never yet envisioned for them over the next 6 months. And it will talk fundamentally about the question you just raised, over area coverage. And that is going to be a hard discussion for the culture and the protocols within the department. But it's a needed change. So everybody's really clear. It's a needed change.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Commissioner, I'd like to conclude first by thanking you for the enormous amount of time and emotional commitment and organizational resources you brought to this event. I think that any organization that openly acknowledges its problems deserves our acknowledgement and credit. This is not an easy set of issues or incident to deal with, and you're to be applauded in how you've handled this in a very forthright, very open manner in acknowledging the hard issues. As one who experienced this event going north and south on the 12th, and he saw something that I've never seen before, which was I was delayed only 2.5 hours going north to a speaking engagement to Tyson's Corner, but coming back from Tyson's trying to get on 95 South, there was a big backup at the Springfield Interchange. And I was thinking, you know, this event was closed hours ago. What could this be? Well, there is this brand new wonderful ramp that goes down on an arc to 95 South, and what happened was it was a solid sheet of ice. And cars and 18-wheelers were taking it sort of like a slip and slide in the summertime, one at a time, and literally sliding down this ramp at a 45-degree angle. In retrospect, I said, what on earth was I thinking when I did that?
That's all.
And the reason I did it is because the car in front of me did it. And when I came back, I counted the number of wrecked vehicles just on 95 between Springfield, and there was a subsequent closure in Caroline County that held me up for another hour coming back. I counted 43 vehicles that were very seriously damaged along the side of the road. Probably many others had been already carted away. But I think one of the lessons there is the importance, as the commissioner has highlighted, is communication, because people tend to do what the car in front of them did. If people are running a yellow light, they're gonna run it. And so we have an affirmative responsibility to prevent that kind of unsafe behavior in the future. And I would also close, Commissioner, by saying there are very legitimate questions about cost, and this board is going to take those up when we look at the budget in the spring. There'll be a dollar amount. There's a risk associated with that, and that's a fairly finite, easy process. The point that the commissioner made at the end about functional versus a geographic responsibility is one that each of you, in particular the district appointees, are going to encounter. And you will have to deal with this on a day-to-day basis as a district representative, and we are evolving to a different structure to manage a system as opposed to a piece of geography, and that's going to be a very, very difficult transition. And so what I would ask is that all of us support the commissioner in this effort, in this evolution, which will be very challenging organizationally. And I do want to just close, Commissioner, again by thanking you with the extraordinary effort on this undertaking. Thank you. Item number 2 on the agenda is the Greater Richmond Transit Study presentation, and I'd like to welcome Mr. John Lewis, who's the executive officer at GRTC, one of our great and growing and very well-managed transit systems in the Commonwealth. Mr. Tucker, did you have any words of introduction as a former employee there?
It's a very well-run transit system. But I think Mr. Lewis is going to come up and present to the board the most recent study of the Greater Richmond Transit Company. I think what you'll notice, GRTC has a history of being a very effective and efficient transit system. I think the key issue for the Greater Richmond Transit Company is really matching the future needs of this region. I think from a practical point of view, if you think about Richmond, that folks are not necessarily connected to where the jobs are. And from a GRTC perspective, it's one of their responsibilities figuring out how to do that. And as this region expands over time, a key issue is going to be how do we offer more mobility options in the region.
Okay. Mr. McCarthy, did you have any introductory comments before we turn it over to Mr. Lewis?
I want to welcome Mr. Lewis to the Commonwealth Transportation Board. He runs one of the most efficient bus systems in the country. You'll hear a little bit more about that. But just to give it a little context, what Mr. Lewis is going to be talking about today is the operations of the Greater Richmond Transit Company and how they can be improved and expanded to serve the people of the metropolitan area better. And that is complementary to a wider study by the local MPO regarding what would mass transit look like if it really worked over the next 20 years or so region-wide, because we are the largest region in the country of 1 million people or more without a comprehensive regional transit system. And we have an excellent core to begin with, and some of us have been working with DRPT and with the Secretary to get more money into the transit system. So here is your first look at what the future might start to appear to be. So welcome, Mr. Lewis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Matt, and Mr. McCarthy. I really appreciate those kind words, although I will, in terms of truthfulness, say that it probably has a lot more to do with my predecessor and Matt's work at GRTC than anything I've been able to accomplish there. I will have promised them I'll do my best not to screw it up while I'm there. But in echoing Mr. McCarthy's sentiments, we really have, in through this comprehensive operational analysis, an opportunity to really transform public transportation in the Richmond region. When I came, joined GRTC in March of 2005, sat down with our board and through a series of meetings, we really decided to go a little bit beyond. COAs, operational analysis, transit systems across the nation periodically take a step back and look at their operations, how are they meeting the needs of their traveling public, are they meeting efficiencies and effectiveness and performance measures that many systems set up. Normally, they tend to play around the edges when they make changes that come out of these analyses. We decided to take a totally different tack. We sat down with the consultant that came on board. We gave them a blank slate. We said, if you were creating a transit system for the Richmond region, and you had the opportunity to create a brand new, what would that system look like? And that was the task that we set before them. As Mr. McCarthy said, at the same time, the Richmond MTO was embarking on a regional study. So it really became a perfect opportunity for these two studies to operate in tandem and not only take a look at our current operations, but what is the possibility for public transit throughout the Richmond region. As I stated, our COA focused on the short-term operational analysis of what our current operational area looks like. How do we meet the needs of those traveling within the city of Richmond, the county of Henrico, and to a very small extent, transit in Chesterfield County? We did not go beyond that operating footprint. That was the purview of the MPO study. We looked at a 3 to 5 year horizon. We came up with short-term recommendations that immediately would have impact on our service area, as opposed to the MPO study, which had a 20-year horizon, looked at the entire region and made a range of recommendations from short-term, medium-term to long-term, and most importantly, to recognize the funding challenges that would come along with those recommendations. In our process, we started with an extensive look at our current bus service area, demographic studies of our current ridership, and of the region in which we serve, again focusing on those three jurisdictions, Richmond, Henrico, and Chesterfield, historic GRTC trends and ridership, the makeup of our vehicle fleet, and optimization of that vehicle fleet, and then something that's very important, a peer review. We had very clear information on how we operate in the past and are currently operating, but how can we benchmark ourselves in terms of performance measures to similar transit systems nationwide. So we entered into a peer review that looked at capital cities, transit systems of our like size, had the similar operating area, but also, which is a very unique situation for us, agencies and cities that had major universities within them. We took a look at our ridership data over the years. We also did a very intensive customer survey. We looked at, did a survey of our current riders, where you're coming from, where you're going, the types of trips you're taking, the frequency of those trips. But also more importantly, we looked and we did surveys of people who do not take our system for various reasons, whether or not they choose not to because of they have other transport options. But the one of the things that came out of that was that you just don't go where I need to go. So a coming out of non-user survey gave us a wide range of information that was very pertinent to this study. Then finally, route diagnostics, which specifically focused on creating and or changing routes in our system to more to better meet the traveling patterns of this region, but most importantly, to set up a series of performance measures by which we could evaluate performance of individual routes, individual buses along that route, and then the system as a whole. And those set of performance measures dovetail very well with VDRPT's statewide performance measures for transit. Out of that series of recommendations came three phases out of those. Phase one was immediate route and service improvements, where we made changes to our route structure. Two, implement the transfer center concept, which I'll go into in more detail later. And three, develop a bus rapid transit line. Next slide. We took a look at our service area. This is a demographic population density map overlaid with our service area. Certain things came to light which were not surprising. Within the downtown, that center circle, is a downtown Richmond centered around the Richmond city of Richmond area. We have very good bus service in those areas which has the highest density, the darker colors. Areas where we have limited bus service, southwest into Chesterfield, along the Hull Street Midlothian corridor. Very limited service, although population density in most cases would support transit. And then into the northwestern areas of Henrico along the I-64 and Broad Street corridor.
Ms. Lewis, could I just stop and just comment? You know, we talk a lot about transportation and land use. That simple diagram kind of says it all. Where there's density, you have the opportunity to provide better bus service. Where the density tapers down, you just simply, it is not, it's not economical. And so as we think about these issues and think about our work with Richmond Region and Northern Virginia, Hampton Roads, there is that land use component that's necessary to make all of this work. And I don't mean to interrupt, but I think it's a very, very important point.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better. And that graph really shows through exactly what the Secretary was stating. Then briefly, a historic ridership. We took a look at, back 5 years, ridership at GRTC has consistently been ratcheting up. There have been several valleys in FY05. That was when we reduced, we eliminated, there was a dip because we eliminated our discount bus tickets, but you can see the very next year in FY06, we not only recaptured that ridership, but also surpassed that from the two prior years. Also at the same time, there was a Hurricane Katrina happened and gas prices skyrocketed. We had a small dip in FY07, but when we're looking at projections in FY08, it looks like that we will not only surpass the ridership from 07, but perhaps even get as high as the peaks in FY06. The peer review. We looked at many different areas to compare ourselves to our colleagues nationwide. Some of the things that really came to the forefront was on the areas of cost effectiveness. And this data came from the Federal National Transit Database that all transit systems nationwide participate in. Again, looking at capital cities, likewise size in terms of operating area, fleet size, and also university cities. These are the peers that we studied in our survey. The GRTC, as Mr. McCarthy mentioned, rates very high in terms of cost effectiveness. Cost per trip, the average cost per trip one way is $2.25. That's what it takes for us to put that vehicle on the street to provide fuel, driver, et cetera, the immediate operating cost for that vehicle. Revenue that we take on average for that single trip, 71 cents into the fare box. Therefore, our subsidy is about $1.53, very high when compared to our peers. Albany, New York, for example, their subsidy per trip is $3.44. So in terms of our cost effectiveness and operating efficiency compared to our peers, GRTC ranks very high. The reason for that, one of the major differences that we saw between GRTC and the other systems is that we are a peak period system. We have a lot of service on the street in the morning rush hour, a lot of service on the street in the afternoon rush hour, and then that service drops off precipitously in the midday and in the evenings. So we focus our service when there is the greatest amount of demand for it. And that is reflected in our cost effectiveness there. That is a policy statement, decision for boards. Some of our colleagues have decided to put similar amounts of transit service on the street day round. Our board has decided to focus upon and remain focused on a commuting hours. Major recommendations out of the COA. One is new service, transfer center, and then a third, very new system, bus rapid transit. Our new service, again, a demographic, a population density graph. If you look at the blue areas, those are areas where there is the greatest amount of density. The new service recommendations that came out of the COA was to extend some current city lines that operate in the city into the suburban areas of Henrico and into Chesterfield. That is not, there will only be extensions of that service. There's no new service envisioned in those areas, just extensions of current operating lines. We will also be eliminating some lines that do not meet the minimum thresholds established in our performance measures. But the major recommendation came out of it was the need to connect these population centers with work centers. Number one, specifically the Route 288 Express. If you look at the southern terminus of that black line, it connects the very quickly developing area between Hull Street, Midlothian, and Chesterfield along the 288 corridor with the job centers and development in western Henrico at Short Pump in Innsbruck. Second, new express service in Mechanicsville into the city. And then third, Chester Express, recognizing the impending new development in the southern area of our region as a result of the vast expansion of the military base at Fort Lee. Transfer center. Why introduce a transfer center? One of the flaws of our system that came to light in our COA was the need for, unfortunate need for many of our passengers to take more than one bus to reach their destination. About 25% of our overall passengers, and we take about 40,000 trips per weekday, Monday through Friday, almost 10,000 of those require transfers. And you will see those along the spine of our system, along Broad Street. People who are getting off one bus, waiting on a bus stop at a corner for the next bus to come by. A transfer center can provide increased customer convenience, increased economic development opportunities, specifically along the Broad Street corridor, as a result of not having crowds of people waiting on the corners. These transfer locations, as I stated, center along Broad Street. Broad Street is the spine of the GRTC system. On any given weekday, we have over 700 vehicles operating up and down the Broad Street corridor, and the vast majority of these transfers happen at these locations where there are stars. outlet. At any time you can go out of this door, take a look at Broad Street, you have lots of people standing on corners waiting for the right bus to come by, not the next bus. And that is the problem. Because we're a peak period service and off-peak right now, that could mean an individual will have to wait 30 to 45 minutes for the right bus to come by. It is a bottleneck for us in our system. It's an inefficient way of operating, and it certainly is an inefficient way of getting from your origin to destination when you have that long waiting period in the middle of your trip. Establishing a centralized transfer center will alleviate this problem for us. The areas that we're looking for, we have been working with the City of Richmond and VDRPT to focus our efforts on the Main Street Station area. Really, to the proposal we have before us to recapture the historical nature of that center, which historically was an intermodal facility, both for passenger rail and freight rail. That is one of a kind nationwide that has that type of historical nature to it and architecture. We will recapture its original facade, open up that station, and make it a truly multimodal center. We've been working with VDRPT to make sure that our plan does not have any negative impact on the state's plan to increase passenger rail service at this location. We will then connect that transfer center through the downtown area with a free shuttle, thereby eliminating the need for people to transfer at bus stops throughout the downtown area. Our downtown shuttle will be a very frequent service, operating, I would imagine, 10 to 15 minutes, so no one will have to wait on the corner for the right bus. As soon as the shuttle comes by on a very fast headway, they can get to the transfer center and make their transfer as needed in a transportation facility. Bus rapid transit. This is truly the jewel of this study. As I stated before, the Broad Street corridor is the spine of our system. Over 700 plus vehicles operating on this corridor a day. It's inefficient for us, not only because of the need for transfers, but just the sheer volume of vehicles on that corridor. It is primed for a much more efficient rapid transit mode. Ideally, and this corridor has been studied in the past for light rail, but we believe that bus rapid transit is a more effective and certainly cost-effective means of getting rapid transit through this corridor. What is BRT? Dedicated running ways. Next time you're out on Broad Street between 2nd and 14th, you may notice on the curbside a yellow lane with the diamond HOV symbol in it. We are working with the City of Richmond right now to have dedicated bus lanes for our current service, and once we establish bus rapid transit, we will extend that dedicated bus lanes. The key to this system is that bus needs to be able to beat the car through the same corridor. Having dedicated lanes, no longer competing with vehicles in that, goes a long way to meeting that goal. Substantial stations. We're going to get rid of most of the bus stops along that corridor and replace them with stations, just like a light rail station where individuals will pay their fare at the station. When the vehicle gets there, it will be an easy ingress and egress onto the vehicle so that the vehicle can move along the corridor. Intelligent transportation system applications. Two things we're looking at in there. Right now, our vehicles have been equipped with GPS systems, which will enable us to more efficiently manage our system from a strategic basis. But also, now that we know exactly where every vehicle is within the system, we can provide real-time information to our customers on where their vehicles are. Our goal is to be able, at some point, to get rid of our schedule and go specifically to a headway system. The prevalence of PDAs, computers, laptops, wireless devices are rampant throughout our ridership and our society. We envision a system where an individual can sign up and say, I take this vehicle at this time at this location, let me know wirelessly through an email or through my PDA or my cell phone when that vehicle is 5 minutes away, for example, or 10 minutes away, or more importantly, let me know when that vehicle has a problem. If it's stuck in traffic or if there's an accident or some other unforeseen circumstance that will preclude that vehicle from getting to its point on time. Really changing the face of transit with that real-time technology. Lastly, also to have signal preemption, again, so that we can maintain rapid transit through the corridor. Limited stops, strong identity and branding. When you look at the two photos that are in front of you, The bottom right is a light rail vehicle in Europe. The top left is a bus vehicle that's operating in Los Angeles. We had specifically designed these vehicles to have larger capacity, articulated, and look very different from a regular urban bus. That's the fund source for BRT. Where are we going to get the money for them? The Federal Transit Administration has a very small starts program, very different from small starts and new starts. New starts is where I believe the Dulles project is coming from. Very small starts has a threshold of less than $50 million, specifically geared towards immediate implementable projects. It has a much lower threshold for federal review. There isn't the need to go through the kind of review process that a small start or a new starts project will have to go through. The goal of this funding source is to get projects on the street as quickly as possible. There are project qualifications for BRT. We discussed some of them in the previous slide. Substantial transit stations, signal priority, low floor vehicles, special branding of the service, frequent service, 10 to 15 minutes, service offered at least 14 hours a day, and lastly, existing corridor ridership exceeding 3,000 per day. One bus line on the Broad Street 6 currently operates on average 4,200 passengers a day, so we more than meet the corridor ridership, and we expect that ridership to more than double once this service is implemented. And then finally, meeting the cost threshold of less than $50 million. What that system will look like. The terminus will be Willow Lawn on the west end, intermediate stations through the downtown area along Broad Street, through our transfer center and Main Street station, and then finally ending somewhere on the Route 5 corridor along Rockets Landing. Now this is phase one of this project. We expect and are looking to design this so that in future phases we can extend east, recognizing the rapid development along the Route 5 corridor and Henrico, and west, perhaps to Short Pump, and recognizing the current dense development along that corridor and future development. But this first phase, we're looking to A, stay under the $50 million threshold, and B, to be able to provide relief to the Broad Street corridor and get rapid transit through that corridor. I certainly do not want to underestimate the key or undervalue the key goal of this is to get this on the ground and operating as quickly as possible. Conclusion, our funding needs. We have a request in the BDRPT for planning and design work for the Broad Street BRT project, $900,000. This is very key in terms of the timeline for implementation. Next year, the Congress will begin reauthorization of the Safety Lou, the Surface Transportation and Infrastructure Bill. We need to have design and engineering completed so we have a complete project, a document that we can take to FTA, to Congress, to get in line for funding for this project. And then anticipating federal funding, we will need the local match for that small starts funding of BRT. We can't imagine, again, with the total threshold being $50 million, so the maximum local match we would be looking is for local match on a $50 million project. This planning and engineering will figure out, designate exactly what the cost of the project is, and then we can come back for local match next year. And then second, for our downtown transfer center. Right now we have a $1.2 million federal grant to take 0 to 30% design and NEPA study for the transfer center. We're requesting BDRPT $3.5 million to take that design from 30% to 100% design. And that concludes my presentation. If there are any questions, I'd be more than pleased to answer.
Thank you. Great presentation, Mr. Lewis. Mr. Bowie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very impressive presentation. I have a couple of questions. First, the subsidy for trip now is $1.53. To make these improvements that are outlined, how do you anticipate that will affect the subsidy for trips?
I do not. The one improvement that may have an impact will be the bus rapid transit. The transfer center is a purely capital expenditure, so it's not involved in those operational numbers. But bus rapid transit, I believe that our subsidy per trip will go down for two reasons. More efficient operation right now along that corridor. We get to take the vast majority of those 700 vehicles and put them into more frequent service in the outlying areas of the city. So we get better service for our customers, thereby increasing ridership. Along that Broad Street corridor, we will be using less vehicles. We're using a smaller number of vehicles with larger capacity. So the cost driver for us, essentially, is the driver and fuel. So if I can get twice the amount of people in one vehicle, then my cost effectiveness increases. So I anticipate that once this bus rapid transit is implemented, that our subsidy per trip will drop.
The second question, I would assume that the gasoline prices bound to increase your ridership. To what extent do you anticipate that will affect your subsidy?
Well, gas prices, I will tell you, is a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it absolutely has increased ridership, and anecdotally, what we have seen over the last 2 years is every time gas prices get around $3 or higher, we see a spike in ridership. Over the month, our ridership in February compared to last year was 10% higher this year than it was last year. The bad news is I buy diesel fuel in 5,000 gallon lots every day. My cost for operations has gone up substantially. So remember, we enter into a long-term contract for fuel April 1st. Today I'm paying $2.19 a gallon for diesel. April 1st I'll be paying $2.61. 3 years ago when I first started, we were paying $1.02 a gallon. So our cost for everything is going up. Other than healthcare, it's our highest cost for operation.
Thank you.
Ms. Davidson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm curious if you believe that you can operate all this at ground level and you're not going to have to elevate or have ways of moving the traffic without crossing existing traffic patterns. Is this all envisioned to be at ground level and stopping for lights and so forth?
It's at ground level. It meshes exactly with the city's downtown master plan. Specifically along Broad Street, the city is looking to make it more pedestrian friendly, to widen the medians, to make it more of a boulevard effect. So our proposal to take away one lane of traffic so that we can operate rapid transit through that corridor. So we will not be competing with vehicles in that corridor, and we will have signal preemption so that when we come up to a light, as emergency vehicles do, fire engines do now, a light that is yellow will stay yellow. If it's green, it will stay green longer. If it's red, it will cycle through faster so that we can maintain flow of our system. But it's all at grade. That's the reason why we're able to keep our costs of construction low.
Mm-hmm.
Mr.
Coleman.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the outline of the plan. As someone who represents a complex region as you do, there are some political dimensions to these plans as well. I have a question about the long-range transit plan the MPO is working on. What happens after that study occurs and is released in May? Does that provide some impetus to further discussion among the various jurisdictions or gives your board what it needs to proceed forward, or how does that fit with what you've outlined?
That's a very good question. What our study is what we're looking at is with our current operating partners right now, the state, the city of Richmond, and RICO County, and how we can move these immediate projects forward. And we're already in discussions with them on moving our plan forward. The reason the MTO's plan is much greater, it's a much greater horizon on it, and certainly a much higher cost attached to it. If you're going out to the long-term recommendations, which could be light rail and heavy commuter rail, that is going to take quite a bit of cooperation and coordination between all of the jurisdictions in the region. I believe it's the MPO's plan with the
the coordinating committee that has representation, elected official representation of all the regions on there, to really take the recommendations of that study and to begin to move forward to figure out, A, how they're going to fund it, what is the mechanism for funding it, if they want to move forward with particular levels of those recommendations, and what is the entity in which they can do that.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Mr. Lewis, thank you once again for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us. A very exciting presentation. We wish you luck, and I look forward to working with you in the coming year to advance your priorities.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and members of the board.
The next item on the agenda, number three, is a statewide rail plan update. While Mr. Page is bringing that up, I do want to acknowledge the presence of the father of the statewide rail plan and the rail enhancement fund, Mr. Whit Clement, who's quietly working his BlackBerry in the back of the room. Welcome, Mr. Clement.
Back there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Before I start my presentation today, I would like just to have a follow-on discussion about some of the progress of what I briefed the board on at the last meeting, concerning respectfully our rail enhancement fund agreements and the progress we've moved forward on those that were funded back in December 15th of 2005. The Gainesville-Haymarket agreement, which is a major investment study, feasibility analysis, and preliminary design engineering for the extension of the Virginia Railway Express out to the Gainesville-Haymarket area, which is in the same footprint of what we were discussing at the last meeting about the $40 million agreement that we're working with Norfolk Southern on. That agreement has come to terms and been executed. VRE has begun work on this project to move forward with the feasibility analysis and the engineering of the design improvements, and that completion date will be set at a milestone of May of 2009. Following that study results, we'll move forward with the next iterative process to actually go forward and start final designing those projects that have been identified and moving to expand the Virginia Railway Express service to the Gainesville-Haymarket area. As well, and I'm sorry Mr. Schwartz is not here today, but I also want to thank the board and others that were here at the last meeting that commented as well about the I-81 Phase 1 improvements contract agreement and the sensitivity that we need to have with the preservation easements, particularly those that were up in the Front Royal area behind the Virginia Land Port. We went back as an agency, pulled together a meeting that was chaired by Chip Badger, our deputy director, on March the 3rd. We pulled together the Virginia Outdoors Foundation, the Piedmont Environmental Council, Warren County Administrator, representatives from the Warren County Board, and Norfolk Southern. And we all came collaboratively together at this meeting at the Virginia Inland Port to discuss the issues and the concerns of both the community and the Environmental Council, and have Norfolk Southern give some dialogue about the best and structured approach as to how we can alleviate the greatest impact that we could have on these easements. Follow-up to that, last Thursday, the Virginia Outdoor Foundation came forward and unanimously approved the conversion diversion of the easements that were in question to the least impact possible. And Norfolk Southern also came in offering of several alternatives that were accepted by the Virginia Outdoor Foundation to advance and move this project forward. In addition to that, the comments of the board were also conveyed back to Norfolk Southern respectfully about the parking of trains on sidings. The passing tracks, as they may, that are part of the four-track project that we have on the Manassas to Front Royal area, as well as the five-mile double-track section behind the Virginia Inland Port, Norfolk Southern has responded to say that they will only park trains on there while they're waiting to pass or in extreme emergency situations brought about by a force majeure event like a hurricane or flood or some event of catastrophic failure of service. So that has been a very positive dialogue, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. As we move forward as well, this is another great monument for the Department of Rail and Public Transportation and for the Commonwealth Transportation Board, is that we've also come to terms with the Commonwealth Railway Incorporated to actually go to closure on the contract agreement that would provide the Commonwealth's funding for the purchase of the line section that the Commonwealth Railway will be operating from Norfolk Southern. Now, what is monumental about that is that also achieves dual access to not only the Maersk terminal, but also the future Craney Island terminal to be developed by the Virginia Port Authority. That agreement will be executed probably in the next 2 to 4 days, business days, and Maersk and the Commonwealth Railway, Norfolk Southern CSX, have come to deal in terms, and we hope to see service of containers coming off of that port as early as April of this year. So that, Mr. Chairman, with the follow-on to the Arkandale-Powell's Creek VRE agreement, which is in development, we hope to have all the December 2005 actions and contracts underway by the end of next week. So that's the beginning of my report and update for you, sir.
Okay, before we get into the presentation, are there any questions about that? That's a lot of very, very significant achievements that really span the entire Commonwealth, the benefits of those. So, thank you, Mr. Tucker and Mr. Page. Any questions about those? And I do think of those, you know, I think there has always been a perception that somehow rail and transit projects are easy and highway projects are hard. And what we have learned is that all transportation projects present challenges. Whether it's in Tyson's Corner or the Virginia Outdoors Foundation, there were some very legitimate issues that had to be negotiated and really a balance struck among competing interests. So thank you for achieving that balance. It's not easy. And we're going to continue to deal with these types of issues as we expand the scope and reach of our rail and transit programs.
Can I just clarify, Mr. Chairman, I've lost sort of track of if the VRE, what kind of schedule would this moving into this phase mean in terms of ultimate operation, assuming, of course, that we had the money to pay for it. But what would this provide as a next major thing?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Connolly, this is the first of an iterative approach and step process to get us to implementation service. This is the beginning of what's called a major investment study feasibility analysis. From this analysis, we will move forward to preliminary engineering of those operational and structural challenges as they may. Following that will come 100% engineering, and then obviously at that point, funding will have to be established through VRE on how to build this project. Obviously, it's going to probably be a collaborative approach of federal, state, and local resources to make that happen. Following that, then obviously there would be a construction phase of that. I would very easily say that including the environmental process of that, you're talking in terms of a couple of 3 years.
3 years to get to the construction phase?
Funding provided, yes.
Okay. If there's no other questions, Mr. Page, welcome, and we're looking forward to your statewide rail update.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. As we have in the past and will continue to do so, the Department of Rail and Public Transportation likes to come forward to the board and brief them on rail issues in Virginia. Today I'm going to provide a state rail plan update just to kind of give the board some background information about railroads in general in Virginia, both from a freight and passenger perspective, kind of give you an overview of where the global marketplace is headed, the structural movement of commodities and people, and also freight, and then move forward into briefing the board on where we're headed with our rail plan update for Virginia. This slide that's before you today is probably not new to this board. It's been used several times in different iterations under the V-Trans project and also on the statewide multimodal freight study. And as the board's well aware, the V-Trans and the multimodal freight study effort continues to identify and track the movement of freight in Virginia. DRPT is no different as we move forward in how we try to work ambitiously to be partnerships in this. And from this map, it can be seen that the major truck and rail freight movements by highway in particular are the I-81 and the I-95 corridors, obviously being fed by the Port of Norfolk up 64 and also up and down the eastern seaboard as well. Major rail freight flows follow a very similar pattern. Instead of following 64, they tend to follow east and west, either over the Harbor Corridor or up the James River on CSX. We also see that major distribution centers, which are marked in the yellow dots on your screen, are followed by good road and good rail improvements and accessibilities as well as population centers. The Port of Norfolk and the Virginia Inland Port, as we are well aware of, are typical examples of clustered distribution centers because of good road, good rail, and port access. And a follow-on to that, just in comment, as you can see, there are clustered distribution centers around the Richmond area and also Roanoke out in southwest Virginia, which shows that there is also opportunity for inland port operations and also good road and rail services that can provide and provide for distribution opportunities in the Virginia area. We have two Class 1 freight railroads in Virginia, CSX and Norfolk Southern. We also have 10 short line railroads that have come about due to spinoffs from the Class 1s or have been short line railroads their entire history for now over 150 years. There are approximately 3,300 miles of track in Virginia, and we see 116 million tons of freight that are carried over these railroads on an annual basis. Coal continues to be the largest commodity shipped in Virginia, with 60% of the 116 million tons being represented by coal movements. I want to do note, and this is not new news to this board, that intermodal cargo continues to grow and be an initiative that we will continue to work with on a regular basis with our rail partners. The Commonwealth is experiencing what we refer to as rail corridor-specific growth patterns. Norfolk Southern's Heartland and I-81 Crescent Corridors and the CSX I-95 Rail Corridor, and now what they're calling the National Gateway Project, which I'll talk about in a minute, have surfaced since our 2004 rail plan update. And coming to the global marketplace, we've seen Virginia flex very quickly to react to that, and as Virginia and the rest of the nation respond to those challenging transportation logistics that are brought about by the global marketplace, road and rail freight interfaces are becoming more critical for the movement of global freight into and out of the Port of Virginia and up and down the eastern seaboard as well. So what we're seeing is a change in commodity flows that we used to see. We're seeing the north and south from the southwest to the northeast, and we're also seeing a growth in intermodal traffic coming in from the Port of Norfolk trying to feed into the Midwest. And as noted on the previous slide, as I mentioned, the Roanoke region has a cluster of distribution centers and areas as well. The proposed Norfolk Southern intermodal facility in the Roanoke region will enhance the region's ability to remain a competitive economic engine for the Southwest as a stop on the Heartland Corridor's global trade route that's being developed by Norfolk Southern. The Roanoke region is also on Norfolk Southern's I-81 Crescent Corridor, which is under development, and this region could benefit from being an originating and terminating destination for intermodal traffic when the I-81 Crescent Corridor is envisioned and developed by Norfolk Southern. Along the I-95 corridor, CSX continues to develop its own east-west intermodal business unit. Although it runs north and south primarily through Virginia, this corridor is called the National Gateway Project, and upon completion, we'll have a double-stack corridor service from the Port of Norfolk, north through Richmond, through Washington, D.C., and then turn west of Baltimore to go to the Midwest. So very similar to the Heartland Corridor Initiative, and that is how CSX and Norfolk Southern can continue to provide good intermodal business out of the Port of Virginia and into points of the north and northeast and in the western region of the United States.
Chairman, Kevin, has there been a lot of feedback after we had the economic impact analysis done on the inland port in the Roanoke Valley and the benefits that would bring to that region? Have you had very much feedback on that and people jumping on that wanting that site there? Other than I know Salem wants it.
Right. Thank you, Mr. King. I think that overall the economic analysis report has been positively received by the region. Both press reports and comments by others have been positive up to the aspects of the benefits that could be brought about to the region by the development of this facility. We continue to work forward on the 10-site evaluation with the understanding that we found that the sites that we will narrow the focus on will all gain the benefit of about an equal amount of economic opportunities once one of these sites is developed. So we can continue to move forward with that.
And the other thing I will just highlight from that economic report, I think for members of the board who may not be familiar, what the report identified is that about 3,000 jobs could be created as a result of locating the intermodal facility in the Roanoke region. It talked about that the Commonwealth would achieve a payback in less than 5 years on our investment. A key thing that it really identified is that the intermodal facility itself is more of a pollinator. It draws a lot of activity, creates a lot of jobs surrounding it. One of the key findings of the report was that there's a real timing issue. There's a timing issue in the sense that other states are looking at building intermodal facilities. And to the degree that we do not move forward with the project, it's to the degree that other states may make decisions to advance a project that may either minimize or obviate the need for us to have a facility. That's a very key issue in terms of the timing. The other issue is in terms of the economic benefits that I just mentioned was also relative to size of facility. In other words, as you looked at varying size of facility, larger facility footprint, more economic benefit, smaller facility, lower economic footprint. So it really did point in terms of some key discussion points that are really relevant to the project. But I think we've gotten generally positive feedback in terms of what the positive benefits of the project would be. But I think it's really served as a real strong education tool in terms of the critical timing issues you have with a project like that.
Okay. Thank you. Before I leave this slide, I also want to point out to the members of the board as well, is that we have a pretty significant amount of coal movement in Virginia. What we're seeing is Norfolk Southern is developing what they call the Coal Corridor Initiative, again, getting back to corridor development, where we're seeing a lot of the coal not only being shipped for export now, but it's also being shipped to domestic in-state coal-fired power plants. So we're finding that through the increase in need and demand for power to be generated in the Commonwealth of Virginia, we are working to respond collaboratively with Norfolk Southern on corridor developments for coal movements, both inside Virginia and also for export. We have two passenger rail providers in Virginia that operate both on NS and CSX. And I think it's very clear to just point out to the board that these passenger rail operations, both commuter and intercity, do operate on private railroad operations that are not owned or controlled by the passenger rail operator. The Amtrak operates intercity passenger rail service, and the Virginia Railway Express operates commuter rail service. And it should be noted that Amtrak operates the VRE service under a contractual agreement. This is pretty much commonplace across the United States, where Amtrak is atypically the passenger rail provider for both commuter rail service and contract, and also the intercity rail service. Amtrak operates 11 round-trip intercity trains in the I-95 and US 29 and 64 corridors on a daily basis, with 3 days a week on the Cardinal being the exception. Amtrak carried last year approximately 3.7 million riders on its trains through Virginia. That means that they were all on the corridor runs through Virginia. Of those riders, 930,000 got on or off an Amtrak train in Virginia. And this equates to about 2,500 Amtrak riders a day. The Virginia Railway Express operates 13 round-trip weekday trains, in the I-95 and I-66 corridors. And they carried about 3.4 million riders last year, the same exact time as Amtrak did. And that's approximately 14,000 riders per day. And that's between the Manassas and Fredericksburg, Washington, D.C. corridors. VRE ridership represents almost four times the annual ridership of the Amtrak boardings and alliances in Virginia. And it's very critical to point out as well, as the presenter before me, Mr. Lewis, showed, and Mr. Secretary, you brought out as well, is that for population density and concentration and the appropriate frequency of service, you will find that public transportation is a key guiding factor in market share and providing good service. On-time performance has been a key component of ridership, driven by a rider's confidence and reliability in the services that are provided. Amtrak's on-time performance has averaged a very poor 43% over the past 2007 report year. VRE's performance has increased and improved, however, due to efforts in working with Norfolk Southern and CSX, and they're running about 88% on-time performance during this same period. CSX and the Department of Rail and Public Transportation, the Virginia Railway Express, and Amtrak have been working collaboratively to increase the on-time performance of passenger train services in Virginia. We have had discussions with this board as well as some of our efforts, and we will continue to work to alleviate heat restriction delays. As the board recalls, we did come to terms with CSX in January of this year for a heat restrictions and operations agreement to move forward to improve services provided and heat delays alleviations in the corridor. This entire initiative to alleviate heat delays and improve the levels of service is being accompanied by designing all state-funded rail improvements and proposing all passenger rail services in the Commonwealth to have a goal of a 95% on-time performance. That's a pretty high bar, but one that we feel that the public and citizens of Virginia deserve within 5 minutes of a scheduled time. DRPT is also working aggressively with its passenger and freight rail partners to establish capacity and operating metrics to achieve enhanced passenger rail operations on freight railroads. For example, Amtrak recently provided DRPT with a quick turnaround phase one proposal that could initiate new passenger services in the Lynchburg and Newport News to D.C. corridors. The board will be briefed at the Lynchburg meeting further on that Amtrak report. I want to segue now, if I may, since we've kind of set the footprint of where we are in Virginia for both passenger and freight rail and where we're headed in the global marketplace, to speak respectfully now to our rail plan update. The 2004 rail plan that we last published identified needs but provided little in the way of an implementation plan for Virginia. The document was beneficial to the Commonwealth, however, because of the data that was incorporated in this document was used to generate a go-forward strategy for the Commonwealth of Virginia for the creation of the Rail Enhancement Fund, which was the first and still continues to be the first dedicated revenue source for enhancing passenger and freight rail corridors and services in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Through the Rail Enhancement Fund, the Commonwealth continues to set a pace for America by having a program that has not been mimicked by many other states. And it is in the development of a successful transportation and public-private partnership as we continue to grow this prosperous program. Now that the Commonwealth has a dedicated source of revenue, rail operators are coming to the table to forge new public and private relationships to advance passenger and freight rail in Virginia. This is something we've never seen before in the history of the Commonwealth in such an ambitious way. The 2008 rail plan update will provide quarter development concepts to guide new relationships with our rail transportation partners. Our update will include a constrained financial plan for the development of the six-year improvement program. We will have estimated costs for an unconstrained plan that will also lead forward with a six-year short-term strategy for funding and implementation of service and also lead to a longer-term vision to 2035 to be incorporated as part of the B-Trans 2035 update. This project will bring years of study efforts into an actionable document that we hope will move forward in a strategy to help mold the challenges and set forth good funding strategies and an incorporation of ambitious service improvements for both passenger rail and freight rail in Virginia. We will move forward to prioritize major freight and passenger rail corridors in this document. As I mentioned earlier, we are leaning more towards the rail concept of corridor development. And through that, we'll again have a 95% on-time performance goal. We will work for the freight corridor developments and also identify costs and funding strategies that can be used in a creative fashion as we move forward to make this vision a reality. The rail plan will contain, again, that short-term implementation strategy, something that can be moved forward to an actionable document as part of the six-year improvement program, and also move us forward for a long-term vision of a fully implemented freight and passenger rail program for Virginia. We tend to move forward and build on the guiding principles of the Rail Enhancement Fund. Again, this is a very creative fund that the Commonwealth of Virginia has, and again, one that provides both the public benefit and also the protection of the public benefit as we move forward in corridor and project development. We are working forward with the railways and railroad equipment, rolling stock, rights of way, facilities as being the way that we can support growth in facilities and passenger rail development. We also look forward to continuing the growth of private-public partnerships where we have local and private funds that have come together to be a match grant with the 70% of Commonwealth funds provided through the Rail Enhancement Fund. Again, that's a maximum of 70%. Project policy goals will move forward. We've got to have a benefit cost ratio of greater than one and move forward with the strategies that encourage important strategies for economic development and contribute to the investments in the entire multimodal public and rail transportation system for Virginia. Just to bring the board up to speed on the schedule for the rail plan, we began this initiative in February. We will have, as I mentioned earlier, in April 2008 at the Lynchburg meeting, we'll have a presentation on the U.S. 29 corridor and the short-term action plan put forth by Amtrak. From April through May of 2008, individual members here that will be attending the district meetings will also receive comments during that meeting process, comments on the development of the rail plan, where the public will have an opportunity during the six-year improvement plan hearing to actually provide input on the statewide rail plan. July 2008, we'll come back as an agency and brief the CTB on the document. We will finalize this document by the end of July. We will come back to report to the General Assembly and the CTB on and by September 30th on a resource allocation report as to how we, the Department of Rail and Public Transportation, propose to move forward with the limited resources that we have, and also provide for that the strategies as to how we will move forward the projects in Virginia. Following that, in December, we will also provide to the General Assembly and members of the Commonwealth Transportation Board a report on how we're going to work and deal more aggressively with heat restrictions and alleviate the delays brought about by heat restrictions and other purposes of, brought about by maintenance and operations, particularly in the I-95 corridor. Mr. Chairman, members of the Board, that concludes my rail update for you today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have at this time. Thank you.
Mr. McCarthy.
Mr. Chairman. Picking up on the comments about heat restrictions in the I-95 corridor, I was a frequent traveler on Amtrak in the last couple of 3 weeks or so, and I don't think we had heat restrictions, but we did have some operational restrictions, and that is a continuing thorn. I'm going to be meeting on Monday with the Richmond Transportation Advisory Board, the Chamber of Commerce, and every time I go to that meeting, they always ask me, what are you doing about improvements in the 95 rail corridor? This is the densest part of Virginia, the so-called Golden Crescent, from Newport News and Hampton Roads on up through Richmond and up to Northern Virginia. It is rife for improvement, and it's been, 8 years ago, some money was put into that. A couple of years ago, that original $65 million was supplemented to account for the increased costs since the original projects were scheduled. And I guess I would like to put in a request that we take this corridor seriously and start funding improvements to what we need to do. This is, we all talk about it, but I'm getting tired of going to these meetings and saying, we keep advocating for it, but you got to get to people and put some money into making these improvements.
Well, Mr. McCarthy, I think what I would say, there has been a lot of money put into that, and I would say that the money that was put in back in 2000 had no strings attached. And so the $60 million that was put into that corridor did not have the kind of public benefit requirements that we do today. We've learned from that mistake. And in fact, much of the additional money and cost is due to those delays. If you read the governor's budget, you will see that the 95 corridor is a priority. But I would emphasize to everybody on this board, railroads are privately owned entities, and we have to negotiate, and we have to have a clear sense of what is the public benefit. If you were to add up the sum total of resources that have gone into that corridor between VRE and the 95 rail corridor improvements, I think you would see a very large number. In fact, I think that would be very helpful, Mr. Mm-hmm. Tucker, for you to provide to the board members. I think the challenge is for us to find a way to ensure that we receive public benefit commensurate with the public dollars that are put into that corridor. Some of those issues relate to operations. You mentioned heat restrictions as one. We do have aging private infrastructure in that corridor. We have a railroad that is oriented towards freight. We have how many Amtrak teams a day? 32 Amtrak.
We have
10 in the corridor. 10 in the corridor Amtrak in addition to VRA. So there's a fair bit of passenger rail service in that corridor provided by both Amtrak and VRE. And I suspect probably by this summer you'll be seeing as a consequence of the governor's budget and something more concrete. But I can't emphasize strongly enough, this is a partnership where we're trying to obtain public benefits in negotiation with a private owner. And that has been a very significant challenge for VRE. It remains a very significant challenge for Amtrak service.
Mr. Chairman, Kevin was indicating to me earlier today in answer to a question that we had raised at Roanoke and on one other occasion about the potential of the Commonwealth to acquire a portion of the value of one of these lines, or perhaps even the own track. And I think he indicated to me there's prohibition on that in the Commonwealth of Virginia by law. Is that, did I understand correctly?
That's our understanding from the Office of Attorney General. So what we've done in a matrix of that is to protect the Commonwealth's investment in the case of the purchase of property, like the Commonwealth Railways, that we have a deed of trust and note that's actually filed with the deed. that protects the Commonwealth's investment and also lines us up as a first creditor in the event that the operation be sold or transferred or actually go bankrupt. So we're first in line there. If we were the owner of that property, we would not be first in line as a creditor.
Mr. Chairman, it would seem to me, unless I'm short-sighted in terms of the historical reasons why that may have occurred in the past, either where the private railroads didn't want competition from the public sector, or perhaps a desire to prevent the state from entering into a railroad ownership for a lot of reasons, it might be appropriate for us to take a look at whether or not that law ought to be revisited or whether it's a constitutional provision. I wasn't sure whether it's constitutional or law, to see if there couldn't be potential partnership and ownership by the Commonwealth in order to advance rail construction in Virginia. I mean, I plan to do a little bit more investigating myself, but I'm just curious if it wouldn't be appropriate for us to request that information as well.
Well, we'll certainly take that under advisement. I would go back to a couple of slides, one that Mr. Lewis showed that, you know, talked about density, and the one in this presentation that talks about the frequency of service. And at the end of the day, a lot of it is you compare the daily ridership of VRE to the statewide numbers, is that's a big difference. And so I agree with Mr. McCarthy that the focus and the strongest corridor for passenger rail services reflected in the governor's budget is the I-95 corridor. It is a matter of getting public benefit out of a negotiation. That is not easy to do, and it is not for lack of resources. And I think, Mr. Tucker, when we find a way, and that will take a little bit of doing, but adding up all of the public sector commitments in the 95 corridor between VRE the I-95 corridor improvements will be very, very substantial. Mr. Kuhlman.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to reinforce that a little bit, too, because I think one of the things that we've come to understand, certainly in the recent days, is blind faith in the private sector is not really a sustainable strategy either. The market swings that are currently underway, not just in the financial markets, but really in a lot of industry sectors, lend themselves to an investment effort that isn't necessarily sustained, even though we can identify the long-term interests here for both our citizens and a broader public interest. So that sustainability of effort is one of our goals, I think. And sometimes those of us in the private sector know it can be just as fickle as anything else. Maybe not as fickle as the General Assembly, but perhaps.
And I would note, too, that not so many years ago, the Commonwealth was the principal stockholder of the RF&P Railroad. Again, in retrospect, there are some history might have been written differently. Any other questions or comments? Ms. Tucker, did you want to add anything?
No, I mean, I think one of the key comments I would make is that, you know, one of the things the Secretary and I have talked about is that we want to be able to talk more pragmatically about what it will take to advance passenger rail. Over the last couple of years, I remember my first couple of months here, I stood up and gave a presentation on a third track discussion, and I remember we were talking about minimum partial cost estimates and the fact that we had done a study that we did not have realistic hard numbers or any evidence of engineering done to be able to stand forward to the board and say this is what it will cost to make an improvement. One of the key things that we're changing is that we want to be able to step forward and say this is what it will cost to make the types of improvements that folks have envisioned over time to make passenger rail, particularly as the governor budget outlines along the 95 corridor, realistic. And I think at the end of the day, no one should be surprised that any transportation project is always more expensive than what you think it is. The complexity of the issues that have to come together and reach consensus and agreement on are more difficult than one think it would be. But we are moving forward with an effort to be able to bring forth a package that answers the questions and put forth, really, I think, that ultimate discussion is, can we afford to pay the price for making the improvement? that will be the difficult challenge, I think, moving forward for all of us.
Thank you, Ms. Page, Ms. Tucker. I think, you know, the important part of this presentation, this is kicking off a major planning effort. And as Mr. Tucker said, it will have realistic prices, both long-term and short-term. That's going to be piggybacked on the six-year program hearing. So in addition to dealing with highway reductions in projects, you're going to be having people to testify to you about planning horizons and costs for the rail program. The next item on the agenda, number four, is the legislative and funding update. We're going to start off with Mr. Rick Walton. And Rick, are you going to walk us through it and then pass it off to Mr. Estes? Mr. Pitter, are you going to do it all?
Mr. Pitter's going to do it all, I believe.
Oh, okay.
good afternoon, Mr. Secretary. We had this on the board agenda for last month. There have been some changes since the handout last month. I think all of you have the handout in front of you. There isn't a PowerPoint that's been loaded on. So I'll just briefly walk through this, if I may. There were several themes that we were following this year: abusive driver fees, access management regulations, incident management, overweight vehicles, rapid transit, revenue sharing, and tolls. On page three, there are two bills, House Bill 1243 and Senate Bill 1, dealing with the abusive driver fees. Both those bills provide a mechanism for reimbursement and or offsetting credit for the civil penalties that have been assessed under the abusive driver fee statute, and that statute has been repealed as well. Access management regulations, there were two bills, a Senate bill and a House bill, that are identical, dealing with access management regulations, providing that as of July 1 of this year, the regulation will go into effect dealing with principal arterials, and by October of next year, the regulation will go into effect dealing with minor arterials and collectors. And there will be further provisions under the amendments under the Administrative Process Act. On page four, last month we had, I guess what you call the BSC bills, and this month we have the ASC bills, basically before the Supreme Court and after the Supreme Court on all these pieces of legislation. All these bills were significantly amended after February 29th. Dealing with various fees and sales and use tax in the two authorities. The last bill on that page, House Bill 1578, was a bill that was generated after the Supreme Court's decision, dealing with all the various fees and taxes in that the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority had implemented, and again provides mechanisms for reimbursement of the various fees that have already been collected by the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority. Page five, really nothing of significance there. Some local bills, one, speed limits on rural rustic roads, establishing a statewide speed limit for those roads at 35 miles per hour. A bill dealing with school bus stop indicators and as far as snow removal and maintenance around these school bus stop indicators so school kids aren't having to step over these huge mounds of snow as being one option. The other option, having to stand in the middle of the road waiting for the school bus to come. The Rural Rustic Road Program, we increased the vehicular count for vehicles that can be essentially paved in place as a rural rustic road, vehicles that carry from 1,000 to 1,500 vehicles per day. And finally on that page is a provision that allows the commissioner to develop a community service program for nonviolent misdemeanor offenders. Next, page six, bills dealing with hot lane enforcement. Our perennial bill dealing with hybrids and HOV lanes for 95 and 395 that would allow hybrids to travel in those lanes with, again, a sunset provision in next July. House Bill 1084 is an interesting bill dealing with approval of certain proper conditions which provides that if a local government has accepted certain profits from a developer and VDOT has not objected to those proffers, that those proffers, you know, will be constructed. Finally, on that page is a bill that increases the maximum amount of contracts for which VDOT can undertake with its own employees, as well as local government with their own employees. Bowie and Mr. Keene, on the next page, the overweight coal truck bill, which we were able to work with Delegate Kilgore and get it amended. Apparently there was a problem with the trucks going in and out of West Virginia and Kentucky. And the trooper out there was adding those miles in those two states, and so he was waiting at the border when those trucks came in from Kentucky or West Virginia and writing them tickets. So the way the bill has been amended now is 85 miles within the Commonwealth of Virginia. So I think everybody's now happy with that resolution. House Bill 1478 out of the Charlottesville area again changes the walk, don't walk sign to allow you to use symbols. Apparently a judge was acquitting those being charged with jaywalking because the signs didn't have the hand and the, I guess, the walking thing. They had the letters of walk and don't walk. So that's a change there. On page 8, House Bill 627, Delegate May's bill dealing with the PPTA, providing for an independent traffic and revenue study on the PPTA is over $50 million. Again, only half of those PPTAs that are submitted after July 1 of this year. Actually, something that we do today anyway on these, but again, just put into the code. On page 9, and I will pass the baton on here to Mr. Estes to say a little bit about the new revenue sharing bill that will go into effect, and I believe he's going to have something for the board next month, changing the board's policy on revenue sharing.
Mr. Chairman, can I just ask one question on impact fees proffers? This is 1084. What was that put in to cure or?
My understanding, that bill dealt with the Huntington Metro stop, and they wanted to put a crosswalk in the middle of the block, and VDOT would not allow that to occur. That might be more than I did it.
I'll give that a shot, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Connolly. It dealt with actually an illuminated crosswalk, is what I understand. And really the debate was about who would ultimately maintain something that was kind of that new technology at the time that I think we ended up denying the physical implementation of that. We were concerned as an agency that we didn't have the capability to support that. I think we're still working through some of those issues, but that's really the genesis of that organization.
Mr. Chairman, by illuminated, you mean actual signals in the roadway itself?
Well, yes, sir. School made lights in the pavement or illumination in the pavement to show where that visible crosswalk is. Because, again, I think it was a mid-block type crossing. There was a signal or something like that to show the visible location of the drivers where that crosswalk was.
But this, you assume, has limited ramifications.
We did work with Delegate England very closely on that bill, so there's, I think, adequate coverage for the agency on safety issues. We have, of course, retained the ability to still be at the table on any final approval based on safety and engineering and traffic engineering.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Estes, you want to tell us about the revenue sharing program changes and. This is one, if you could start off with the timing, because I know several members of the board will get questions when they go back home. Do these changes take effect this year or next?
Great start. These changes, majority of the changes are in effect July 1 of this year. We did put the program applications that were going to be due this month on hold. We did send a letter to all localities. I let them know that the applications were on hold for fiscal year 09. Starting July 1. We would like to bring a policy to the board potentially next month outlining what the changes are in the code. I won't take the time to go through everything in detail, but the changes are listed there. And then once we have an approved policy from the board, we'll go back to the local governments and give them at least 2 months to go through their town councils or their county boards to resubmit applications, keep the applications the way they are, and then we'll come back to the board once we have those applications and have those reviewed. So again, our goal would be to update a policy potentially next month, get back out to the local governments with what the ramifications of the changes really are, accept new applications, and then come back to the board shortly thereafter with approval of that.
When would that likely be coming back to the board?
Well, I think possibly it'll be the fall. It'll be September, October timeframe. By the time you get several months to get applications back in, staff review, and then back in time for the board to review those before you approve the application. I think we're looking at about October timeframe right now.
Mr. Chairman, Mike, certainly it changes the criteria that's being applied. Does it in any way change the responsibilities of the board vis-a-vis the application of the criteria?
Well, the criteria, and I'll briefly talk about the criteria change, Mr. Coulombe, is before, the prior criteria was to give priority. There was a tier level of prioritization. First priority went to those localities who were providing an additional match above and beyond the $1 million limit, the limit of what we can fund from the state. Again, it's a matching program. So we would fund $1 million. We give priority to those who are providing more than $1 million from local governments. That tier has been removed by the General Assembly this year. The new tier one will be local administration, and then followed by those who are simply providing more of a match, whether it be over $1 million or 100,000, as long as it's more of a match, and then go down through subsequent tiers. So I don't foresee that the board's role will change from a review of the applications. We'll still look at the eligibility of the projects for you, bring those eligible projects to the board for consideration.
Is everyone eligible for local administration? Are all the jurisdictions eligible for that? Are there only a certain number of jurisdictions that are locally administered?
Mr. Chairman, Davis, it would be open for all localities. That's the 95 counties and the 81 cities and towns who already operate and maintain their infrastructure. The local administration, and this was part of the negotiations around this bill, is going to be delayed effect. You have to see it's the that won't actually be in effect until July 1 of 2009. So what we will do is there's a continued effort on the department to work and partner with localities to offer training, to offer better guidance on what local administration really means to them, and that'll give us another year to make sure we're reaching out to those who may not have, you know, participated in a locally administered project before, but we'll be open to the same folks who are eligible currently for the revenue sharing program.
Any other questions?
Secretary, this is on Senate Bill 153, VDOT Maintenance Community Service Program. This is mowing rights of way, et cetera, or landscaping task for VDOT. We'll call it Dave's chain gang bill, for lack of a better phrase. Is VDOT going to administer this, or does he just create a program? It's locally administered, law enforcement administered?
Law enforcement.
Okay, so this isn't something we're taking responsibility for.
It's basically the same diversion program that the court sentences nonviolent misdemeanants today who pick up litter, who do various things, and this just adds mowing and some of these other VDOT-related functions to the list of community service that courts can award these individuals to do.
Oh, so the courts would actually impose this and say, okay,
right,
did this crime, you're going to go mow lawns on VDOT rights of way for a period of time?
Right.
Mr. Chairman, if I understood correctly, this revenue sharing changes, I meant to thank Mike for the work on this, because I think it addressed most of the major concerns that we had earlier, especially that I had. I meant to thank him for that. I hope I understand fully all of it. I guess when we get to implementation, I'll see if that way.
I'm sure we'll discover new things during the implementation phase.
But thank you very much for working on it.
On the next two pages, pages 11 and 12, are a list of various studies and reports the General Assembly passed this year. House Bill 1116 and 1259, as well as Senate Bill 43 on page 12, all deal with the environmental review process for state projects and for local road projects. Before, the threshold for having a review was $100,000. That's now been raised to $500,000 for both the vertical construction as well as the horizontal or roadway construction that local governments undertake.
HDR 159 is a continuation of the Route 460 Communication Committee that's been around since 2003. HDR 178, as well as SDR 70 on the next page, deal with urban development areas and studying land use and looking at these urban development areas, which, as you all know, involves any jurisdiction with a population of over 20,000 and a 5% population growth, or any area with 50% population growth, and their conference of plans must designate one or more of these urban development areas where there'll be more high density, you know, growth in those areas. So these are further studies and of other land use related initiatives that the General Assembly may need to come up with to encourage more of these urban development areas. HDR 194 is just a study of the road network and Hampton Roads. It's an assessment of present and future needs, and it specifically includes the Hampton Roads Bridge Tunnel, which was somewhat a bone of contention with several members of the General Assembly dealing with the Hampton Road Transportation Authority, the HRBT, was not one of the projects listed as being funded under the HRTA mechanism. SJR 92 on page 12 is a study and looking at the various transportation entities and the localities, looking at the MPOs, the planning district commissions, and the various authorities to see where powers and duties overlap between all of those entities. Again, you know, most of these are one-year studies with interim reports or final reports due not by November of this year, and some of them with final reports due by November of next year. And then finally on page 12 is SJR 122, and I'll let Chip tell you a little bit about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Department of Rail and Public Transportation escaped this session relatively unscathed. We do have one joint legislative study committee that was formed to study rapid transit networks in Northern Virginia. The study committee will be comprised of 10 members, 6 from the House, 4 from the Senate. They'll meet 4 times and are to conclude their work by November of 2008, and our agency will serve as technical support. We'll see how that plays out.
Okay, any questions about the 2008 legislative session? Is it Oates? Mr. McCarthy.
We're not going to talk about tolls today.
We can certainly talk about tolls. The I-81 bill is listed on there. Did you want to talk about that?
I can mention briefly on page 13 there are 2 toll-related bills, one dealing with the Dulles Greenway, which is a private toll road in Northern Virginia, and legislation dealing with how the State Corporation Commission will set future toll rates, looking at a number of different factors. HB 1516 and SB 754 are the 2 bills dealing with tolls on Interstate 81. The governor has signed the House bill and essentially says that before tolls can be placed on Interstate 81, the General Assembly must authorize those tolls.
Didn't like my resolution.
And
we did not support that legislation, and I will say to our colleagues here in the I-81 corridor, that's taking a potential solution off the table.
Finally, on the last page, one bill, HB 1302, an incident management bill. We're hoping that this will give us, as well as the state police, another tool in clearing incidents from our highways which obviously will affect, you know, congestion, particularly in the Northern Virginia area. It allows state police to move vehicles. Today, the scene of an accident is basically defined as the area where the accident has occurred, and they have to do their investigation. This allows the scene of the accident to be expanded to allow them to move these vehicles off the highway, get them off the road, take them to the nearest exit. It also allows individuals who are able to move their automobile. Today, the law says they can only move it only so far as necessary. Now it will say they can remove the vehicle from the roadway. So hopefully we'll cut down rubbernecking and things of that nature as well, if people actually take their vehicles off the nearest exit ramp into a rest area or something of that nature. So
Mr. Chairman, on the I-81 toll bill, I was curious. Wasn't it true that it was only the previous year that the General Assembly granted the authority to the CTB to place a toll under certain conditions, and then the next year they, in effect, took it away? Is that my correct understanding?
That's a not inaccurate description of history. The one caveat I would make to that, many of us believe that the CTB had that authority today, subject to limitations established by the Federal Highway Administration. But you're right, at a minimum, as a statement of policy, this body or the General Assembly established a policy that said the CTB could set tolls on I-81, and that has now effectively been rescinded, saying that any toll, it's unclear if it would have to be the rate or simply the imposition of tolls up or down would have to be established by the General Assembly. Okay, any other questions? Mr. Coolman.
Mr. Chairman, Rick, I noticed the last bill, the SB 210, is an attempt by Senator Stosch, who's a brilliant accountant, actually, to make it easier or remove one of the barriers to concluding more public-private partnership agreements by acknowledging there are trade secrets and proprietary information that often are involved or protected. So that's consistent with the policy of encouraging public-private partnership agreements. I'm worried about the tolls. So is it your assessment this will make it harder to negotiate agreements or simply harder to have agreements approved?
Sure. Could you clarify your question about I-81?
About I-81, no.
I might speculate on Mr. Walton's behalf. When you enter into a negotiation, you need to know who you are negotiating with. And so one of the ambiguities there is the deciding entity is the General Assembly. How does, let's just say, a private or a public entity enter into that negotiation?
And one of the concerns we expressed to the General Assembly during the debate on the bill is the somewhat chilling effect this has, first of all, on anybody willing to spend the money to submit a proposal when they know that they could spend millions of dollars putting a proposal together only to have the General Assembly say, we're not going to lay a toll on them. Knowing that tolling may be the only viable option available to pay to do the improvement. So I think that's the major concern here.
Mr. Chairman, I worry less about the Dulles Greenway related legislation because it's my own view that it's unlikely that future arrangements will mirror those arrangements. That was early in this process, and it has its own set of problems that probably aren't replicated in other corridors and other solutions. But I am worried that this is going to make it much more difficult to deliver the safety and capacity and congestion relief improvements that we know that we need in 81 at some point or another.
This means they've got to be funded.
Perhaps it is a signal from the Assembly that they're prepared to step up with a significant revenue source.
Mr. Chairman, I just point out that by assuming the potential funding responsibility, they have shifted the political burden as well. And sometimes that can be a plus.
Thank you for those insightful comments. I think maybe we ought to spend commentary here. If I could acknowledge the great efforts of Mr. Walton and Mr. Pittard and their respective legislative teams. That's an enormous amount of work that goes into the General Assembly. Something that we don't have on this report because it's something that didn't happen, but on any number of fronts, if you recall, 2007 was a very significant session for land use. And there were very significant efforts to undo many of the gains from the 2000 session, whether it was impact fees, whether it was the extension of conditional zoning to other jurisdictions, the urban development areas, something very, very important, those performance measures for the two metropolitan areas, which, again, this body still has a role in. So those are still in place, but all of those were being subjected to very, very significant challenges. The next item on the agenda, is it 2:30 yet? Should we take a little break? Folks want to take a little break? and come back, or do you want to do secondary street and then take a break?
Let's take a break.
All right, we're going to keep rolling here. Item number 5. Sorry, Ms. Connelly, you got outvoted. Secondary street acceptance requirements.
Where's Mary Lee? I'm here.
Sure. Oh, we need a password to get in. And while we're waiting for Mr. Donahue's presentation to queue up, has everyone had an opportunity to read the regulations? I know it's pretty dry reading. But we will be asking under the business meeting today to advertise. Is that a resolution on the business meeting, or is this just a work session item?
There is a resolution that would authorize we have to start a formal public comment period. Okay.
So we will be asking for action during the business section. Welcome, Mr. Donahue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. I'm here today just to provide you all with a brief update that's kind of just prior to the action agenda. And as you all know, the secondary street acceptance requirement is one facet of the administration's initiative to improve coordination between transportation and land use planning. And as we've said before, the purpose of this initiative is to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of the transportation network, to increase connectivity of road and pedestrian facilities, to utilize context-sensitive design to reduce stormwater runoff and impervious surface area, and help address cost recovery mechanisms to defray VDOT's costs for delays to the acceptance of streets into the state system. I'd like to go over some of the outreach that's been undertaken to date. Last April, after Governor Kane signed Senate Bill 1181, which was the enabling legislation, we published a proactive public comment period and asked people for comments based on the legislation and the existing subdivision street requirements, as well as some of the design requirements of the subdivision street design guide. Afterwards, Secretary Homer established an implementation advisory committee that consisted of stakeholders from local governments, planning district commissions, the development community, the environment community, and other stakeholders. And as I've told the board before, they've met 7 or 6 times over the summer and fall to discuss the regulation and get input from other affected stakeholders. There's been ongoing outreach with the development community through the Home Builders Association of Virginia, as well as certain consultants and others. Over the past month and a half, I've been traveling across the state meeting with various regional planning district commissions to interact directly with local staff and to discuss this draft regulation, as well as get input back from those professionals who are going to have to work with this regulation and VDOT in the future. Additional briefings are being scheduled with some of the planning district commissions that I haven't had a chance to attend yet and brief. And also I've been working with the Virginia chapter of the American Planning Association to reach with outreach for local planning staff and the consultants that work with the development community. Some of the major topics of discussion that have occurred with the outreach to date has been the connectivity concept. It's definitely one of the major concepts. It's, as I've said before, this is one of the major policy shifts that exists in the draft regulation. And there's been lots of discussion, both people who like the concept, those who are trying to better understand, and those who have some concerns with the concept. We've some areas people say they think it needs to be increased, some of the requirements, and others have requested that be reduced. And for the most part, it's just been helpful to go out and discuss this concept with people so they better understand how the link node ratio concept, as well as some of the other external connectivity requirements, work. In addition, there have been extensive discussion regarding the conditional acceptance provisions. And if you will recall, that is the provision where a development or a network addition can come into the state system on a conditional basis due to its limited connectivity, but then if future connections that were promised were never made, that network would be removed from the state system. And there's been a lot of concern expressed by members of the local government community as well as the development community with those provisions. Another topic of major discussion has been the implementation of this regulation. Many stakeholders have expressed the desire to have training similar to that the department undertook the traffic impact analysis regulation, where we went to various parts of the state and held kind of workshops where both VDOT staff, local government, and developers all sat down in one room and discussed how the regulation would work. A lot of people discussed a preference and a desire that we would undertake a similar training process with this. Similarly, they have discussed concerns with ambiguity in the regulation and desire to have a similar kind of guidance document accompany this so that smaller to developers as well as smaller staff at smaller localities will know exactly what the requirements are to have their streets taken into the state system. Based on some of the input that we've received over the past several months, there have been several changes to the draft regulations since the last briefing of the board. And the conditional acceptance provision has been removed from the draft regulation. While I thought that was a very important provision of regulation and would help ensure that stub outs in the future are connected, due to the concern that was expressed by local governments, the development community and others, as well as some of the unintended consequences, we decided it would be best to remove that provision from the draft regulation before bringing it back to the board. In addition, to help address some of the implementation concerns that were expressed, we've had a transition period to the draft regulation. So once the draft regulation, if approved by the CTB, there would be a six-month kind of lag period where developments could come in either under the existing requirements or the new requirements. And that will also help with modification to area types as well as outreach with stakeholders so that they understand the requirements of the draft regulation. It will provide a time period for that training I discussed earlier. And as the chairman said, the board will consider a resolution during the action meeting that will authorize VDOT to start a formal comment period. The regulation will be published in the Virginia Register for a time period to solicit public comments. In addition to that, the regulation, as well as the Subdivision Street Design Guide, which contains design standards for local streets, will be published on the VDOT website to solicit public comment, and there will be continued meetings and outreach with stakeholders, as well as several public hearings throughout the Commonwealth. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to entertain any questions that the board might have.
Mr. Chairman. Nick, you're to be commended for all the work you've done on this. It's been a good job. I know you and this regulation have been joined at the hip for a long, long time. Are there any, actually I ask this, as you travel around the state and heard the concerns of localities, mm-hmm. are there any recurring concerns that have not been addressed by the changes in the regulations from the form in which they were in before you went around the state and now?
There has been one reoccurring concern, and something that's kind of difficult to address in the regulation, and that's kind of the implementation and training. And I've talked with the commissioner, and something that the department and myself are going to work with on over the spring is putting together a draft guidance document that will mirror the provisions of this regulation, provide graphic examples, as well as kind of reiterate these concepts in easier-to-understand language so that we can show that to the local governing officials as well as smaller developers, so they can understand what the requirements are. But that's been one of the major concerns that has been expressed, that has not been addressed in the
right.
current language.
And that makes sense. Is the plan to circulate such a document prior to the time the board is asked to approve the regulations in final form?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. However, the final version of such a document would not be able to be finalized until we had a final version of the regulation. But there would be a draft version of the document. That is the intent.
Yeah.
If I might add on to that question, another concern that pops up is in some quarters there's a belief that the intent of these regulations is to have localities, in particular rural counties, assume road maintenance responsibilities, and that is clearly not the intent. There is a legitimate concern about federal government or state government pushing stuff down to locals. That's a persistent theme, but I think that has come up in a number of hearings, mostly with the elected officials, but the private engineers that deal with this and the local government administrative officials understand pretty clearly what the intent of this and the impact of the regulations are.
I want to add my positive comments to what Ken White just said. I had a number of people from the Culpeper District who voiced concern, who sent emails, and I told Nick I created sort of a target group that I emailed the changes as they occurred in the draft and sent it over to them for review, and I told them to short-circuit it and go straight to Nick. I said, no, you're sending them back to me, and Nick has dealt with several of those individuals directly. Some of their points have been, I think, pretty much on target, and you've answered the vast majority of those concerns. I think the point that the Secretary just raised is one that remains, and it's part of our responsibility in educating local governments and the public on the impact of these regulations. One thing that has occurred repeatedly at Planning Commission meetings in the past couple of weeks in my area has been who has the ability where you have, for example, a connector road that comes out on the primary access road, who has the makes the final determination. My understanding is that it's going to be the administrator of the district that actually can review that and provide a waiver if necessary to the developer in meeting that criteria. You and I talked about that by phone. I just want to make sure that I'm correct in that assessment.
You are correct for the most part. We've actually moved those connectivity waivers down one more step to the district administrator's designee, who I imagine the majority of the state would be the residency administrator. So we start at the local level. So the entity that the developer deals with on a day-to-day basis would be the same person that has the authority to make that decision.
Mr. Chairman, as I was reading the rural area type on page 35, I think I was looking for consistency as far as the sidewalk width and other requirements. And as I read this, it seemed to indicate that 8 feet wide and tree wells are required if it's directly next to the street. Then you go over to the next page, and it says where sidewalks are constructed, which sounds like anywhere, planting strips are required, and they shall be 3 feet in width. So you're talking about 13 feet being required of actually constructed area on a rural-type area road. And I wonder if that's what you intended. Did you intend to require the planting strip, even though you say if it's built immediately adjacent to the road, only 8 feet wide and tree wells are required?
That was not the intent, sir, and I will review this language. This language will go to VDOT's policy shop, who will format it and put it in the correct form if the board does authorize
them
for it.
That's
the intent
thing.
Would be that the planning strip would be provided unless the sidewalk was placed directly next to the street, in which instance it would be 8 feet wide. So that's not an addition. I apologize for that. Thank you.
Well, it may be correct if I read all the details, but I was skimming to see if it fit together.
Mr. Coolidge.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Donahue, I cannot see how, if and how, the handling of the surety fees or cost recovery changes from current structure. Are there any changes?
To the surety section?
Yeah. Not just editing changes, but in terms of the actual accounting, where those fees are actually deposited, how they're accounted for, and so forth. That remains the same.
That would remain the same. Some of the amounts have been adjusted based on VDOT studies and increases in CPI.
Yeah. But the accounting is the same.
Yes, sir.
That's it? Tribute to your very hard work, Mr. Donahue. If there's no further questions, I just want to close by, as we have on a couple of other occasions today, we've closed out some major work efforts today, and the next item we'll be talking about some that we're opening up. But you think about the many years we've spent talking about reforming acceptance of streets, doing a better job, and this is a monumental undertaking, and this will have just tremendous beneficial long-term impacts both for the Commonwealth and for the communities where these are located. So I just want to publicly acknowledge not only your hard work but your excellent work, Nick, and thank you so much for undertaking this. Okay, this will be on the action agenda in just a few minutes. I think we can get through the interstate presentation, then we'll take a short break.
Thank you very much.
And this is just an update on the interstate program status by Ms. Rita Buescher, the Chief Financial Officer at VDOT. Welcome, Rita. And while we're getting that queued up, will we be receiving the draft six-year program at the April CTB meeting, correct?
Yes, we will.
So in about 30 days. It'll be a cheery exercise.
Good afternoon. Mr. Secretary and members of the board, I wanted to give you a brief update on the development of the six-year improvement program. We are working on the interstate portion of the program. As I indicated in February, the state transportation revenue estimates would produce system funding reductions, and I've noted those on the slide as a reminder. Transit is looking at a state funding reduction of approximately 10%, primary, secondary, and urban approximately a 44% decrease. And I think one of the important things to remember is that interstate is not affected by the state funding reductions, that the interstate funding is federal, and at this point that is, we're looking at that to be flat. Now, the Congressional or General Assembly action in the future could change these projections as we go forward.
But, Mr. Chairman, is it not correct that the interstate allocations do impact the primary and secondary because they come right off the top of our allocation?
The primary, secondary, and urban decreases that we're referring to on the screen are from the state funding formulas, where the interstate that I'm speaking of is flat. That funding is through the federal funding.
Yeah, but to get
Ms. Connelly, if I could add in, one of the elements that did survive of House Bill 3202 last year is the statewide bond. There's about $300 million a year of bond proceeds for the next 10 years. The first draw on that is to match all federal dollars. So it used to be the case if you had a federal project, the match was taken off your primary. Uh-huh. That has insulated all the districts from that, and I think is a real advantage and a very good and prudent use of those bond proceeds.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, are all of the actions pretty much finished that would provide revenue to roads on the part of this session of the General Assembly, or is there still some?
We'll be talking about that under new business.
Okay, thank you.
When we started the six-year improvement program update process, we shared with you a summary of the funding guidelines that were provided to the districts for use in their development of their priorities by system, and they are, as you see on the slide, by law, of course, maintenance first. The next thing we look at is the cost increases on completed projects. We must cover those. And then cost increases on, or estimate changes on construction projects that are already underway. And then one of the key factors that we're looking at now, especially with funding reductions or flat funding, we're looking at advancing phases on existing projects in the program. And as always, and maybe sometimes goes unsaid, we are looking to maximize the federal reimbursements using the federal dollars. Mr. Secretary?
I'm sorry. On this, with the guidelines, to what extent do we take into account the levels of service on existing roadways to make sure that we prioritize or put some priority towards those projects that will do the most good rather than be done quickest?
I believe that when the districts review their projects and look at priorities and schedules, I believe they would take the service levels into consideration. Of course, overlapped with the guidelines you see here are the board's priorities for safety, bridges, congestion, alternative modes of transportation, and the system preservation. Now, with regard to the status of the interstate component of the program, the 2008 through 2013 interstate program allocations totaled a little bit more than $1.8 billion. In comparison, the fiscal year 2009-2014 interstate program allocations totaled a little under $1.8 billion. So as I indicated before, the program is relatively flat. The interstate, as I also mentioned, is federally funded with the Interstate Maintenance and National Highway System Fund and only uses state funds as needed to match the federal funds. And as the Secretary indicated, House Bill 3202 allowed us to use bonds as our state match funding. The work we've done to date on the interstate program has been to review by corridor I-64, I-95, I-66, and I-81, and all of the other small interstate corridors, by looking at the project estimates, the schedules, and the allocations to determine that they're current and that we have the information we need to make our decisions. The focus has been to ensure that allocations benefit the interstate system by advancing projects or phases that are ready to go. Our working goal is to accelerate project phases to maximize construction activity and maximize, as I said, federal reimbursement. And at this point, it is unlikely that new projects will be introduced. And as the Secretary started the discussion, we are prepared to bring the draft to the board on April 16th, and that will include the interstate primary and urban and secondary zones.
Mr. Stern,
in some cases in recent projects we've approved, the cost of a project, bids have come in a little bit lower than what it is, results of materials and other things. And obviously we have a new year, 2014, although it's flat across. I mean, how much additional, I'll call it buying power, or purchasing power, construction power, are we looking at as we look across this six-year plan?
I think as you've indicated, the construction bids have been favorable in the recent past, and that will benefit us, I think, and we can perhaps realize some savings when we look at the construction phase of the project. But some of the projects we'll be looking at trying to advance are in the PE and the right-of-way phase, and maybe less impacted or have less of a benefit from the construction savings. And the right-of-way phase may, in fact, still be feeling the impact, depending on the location of the land purchases, on the land prices that we've been experiencing. So that hopefully will have a positive trend in the near term as we've seen the assessments in localities drop.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Fisher, much of our conversation thus far at our district level in Northern Virginia has focused beyond just the construction side of things, and clearly we need additional allocations and operations, as we heard earlier from the commissioner, in signage replacement, intelligent transportation and communications improvements, and so forth. Those are often listed as new projects as opposed to ongoing operations. And I just want to say that, at least from my perspective, some of those operational investments need to go forward, even in a resource flat or resource restricted environment, because they're essential to the capabilities of the system, the workings of the system on a day-to-day basis. So fellow board members, I would suggest to you that you look at those things too and not let some of those things slip in your districts because they're, quote, new projects.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Buescher. I would remind the board that this is the easiest part of the six-year program allocation process, and we will look forward to our discussions in April on the primary and communicating to the affected localities on urban and secondary. That will not be an easy task. We'll take about a 5-minute break and come back and do a very quick business section. Thank you.